Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the program, we'll be talking about politics today in Egypt. And our guest is Ken Cuno. He is Associate Professor of History at the University of Illinois. He teaches on the early modern and modern history of all of the Middle East, although his particular area of interest is Egypt. He's been here before to talk on this subject, and we're pleased to have him back on the program today. Questions as we talk, 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana, folks. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of people who call in is that they just be give us their question and give the other folks that we're listening a chance to get into. We like to keep the program moving along and get in as many people as possible. But, of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to call. Again, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here once again.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here.
To start, perhaps we could talk a little bit about the president, Hosni Mubarak. He has been president since 1981. He had been the vice president, became president when Anwar Sadat was assassinated, and he has been president now all this time in what is amounts to a one-party state.
Yes.
How do Egyptians feel about that, about the lack of diversity in Egyptian politics, and do they make some sort of trade-off between how they feel the country is doing generally and the fact that it is not a free and open democratic system?
Yes, in a word. Yes. Before I generalize, let me say, first of all, we're talking about a country of 85 million people,
right,
approximately,
sure,
and a lot of different outlooks and different currents. And as they say in Washington, where you stand on this question depends on where you're sitting. Middle-class Egyptians, people who feel, you know, that they have a stake in things, especially instability, and feel, therefore, that they have something to lose. They're very apprehensive about change, what might happen after President Mubarak leaves office, probably with his boots on like his predecessors. And so this is exactly it. There's a lot of what I would say passive support for the regime or the government, if you want to call it that, because what's the alternative? The so-called opposition political parties, the legal opposition political parties, the strongest of which has a number of deputies in the parliament in single digits. It's like 6 or 7 or something like that. That's the new Waft party. Are basically no alternative. They've never been able to get much traction. They don't really have comprehensive programs to offer people, which is one of the problems. And then, so the only real political alternative to this regime and the governing National Democratic Party is the Muslim Brotherhood, which has been very impressive in its political skills and its retail politics. In the parliamentary elections 2 years ago, they got about 20% of the deputies and all, despite repression. But there are a lot of doubts about the Brotherhood. Is it really you know, a wolf in sheep's clothing? Is it really anti-democratic? And just, you know, is it going to be one vote, one man, one vote, one time? If they get into power, so the cleverness of the regime, in a sense, has been to repress legitimate opposition to the point where really it's a choice between us or these guys that you don't really trust and you don't want to come to power. A lot of people who worry about their future economically, let us say, either doing a little bit better or just scrambling to stay in place, they worry about a change like that. The Christians of Egypt, who are maybe 10% of the population, the proportion is contested, of course, they're very concerned and worried about the possibility of the Muslim Brotherhood taking over and so forth. So it's, in a sense, it's like, and of course there is positive support as well. I mean, the regime does represent a cluster of interests. The military, it is a military-based regime, always has been. And a business class that has risen up since the beginnings of the new economic direction from the mid-1970s, privatization and so forth. So there is, you know, positive support, but I would say most of the support in the country is this kind of like, if not them, what?
Yeah. Well, Mr. Mubarak now is 79 years old, and there are people are, I'm sure they have been thinking about this and talking about this for some time, but they recognize, obviously, that he's not going to be the leader of the country forever. And a lot of people are thinking about what happens next, who would be the next president. There has been, I think, particularly recently, more and more attention focused on his Mr. Mubarak's son as possible successor. Is there anybody else who would seem to be a likely candidate, or is the feeling is most people's feelings that probably that Gamal Mubarak, his son, is going to be the next president?
Well, despite their denials, and the president's denials and Gamal Mubarak, his son's denials, increasingly it seems like that's what's happening, that the fix is in, the skids are being greased or what have you. There is occasionally the name of a military man who's the head of state security is mentioned as an alternative who might be the preferred candidate of the military. I'm blanking on the fellow's name at this point, but one can look it up. But that simply has to do with the question of whether things have not changed all that much, and whether the military really is going to be decisive in you know who is the successor. I'm not sure that's the case. I mean, I think that it's very possible you could have this shift. And the shift would be if Gamal Mubarak does succeed his father, and it would be through an electoral process. I mean, the way that they would get around this, him saying, I'm not interested, and his father saying, no, there's not going to be any succession, is simply that Mubarak announces at a certain point that he's not going to stand for another term. Then steps back and says, well, you guys, the National Democratic Party, go ahead and nominate someone. And lo and behold, they nominate his son. This is the only legal political party with a national organization. And they regularly get, it was a defeat, quote unquote, when they only got 4/5 of the seats in the parliament in the 05 elections. And they've fixed that by diddling with the Constitution in the last couple of months, which is something I want to get to a little bit later on. Sure. But that's how it would happen. And I think it might not be a bad thing, all things considered, because rather than reaching down into the military officer corps and getting another fellow who's used to giving commands and having them followed with a salute, why not somebody if you can't have everything you want, why not somebody who comes out of the business class and at least has an interest in seeing things not get too dire?
Yeah. Well, he's certainly his back, as you say, his background is in business. He is an investment banker. Yeah. He has an MBA from American University in Cairo.
Which is where I used to teach, by the way.
Not in business. He worked in London for a while for Bank of America. So that's the background that he comes out of. Is there, from what's known about him, is there reason to think that if indeed he became president, that somehow his priorities, his approach to governing would be substantially different from his father's?
Well, the style might be different. For one thing, he would certainly, I would think, bring in a new generation or a new group of people, perhaps gradually, though it's hard to say. I mean, you can think in terms of different scenarios of other countries that have sort of moved from a more authoritarian to a more democratic type system. I mean, one model you might say is Turkey back in 1950 when they had their transition. Structurally, it's not the same as Egypt right now, because in Turkey what happened was you had a single-party state, but then a segment of that one party sort of broke away from the old Republican People's Party to the Democratic Party, led by businessmen in large parts. So, and it was the businessmen that wanted to see the economy as well as the society politics be liberalized a bit more for their interests. So if you have a growing business class in Egypt, as you do, that might be one push in the direction of political liberalization to go along with economic liberalization, at least up to a point. Another kind of model might be Spain, where Franco arranged a succession not with his own son, but with the prince or who became king, Juan Carlos, who sort of kept his cards close to his vest until the old dictator was dead and then kind of let a devolution to democracy happen. I don't think that's very likely, but But we could see some changes. Gamal has a profile in addition to, as you said, an investment banker, as being somebody who promotes himself as a technocrat, sort of a new thinker, this sort of thing. He was very involved in the effort to get the World Cup match for Egypt, and they lost to South Africa, I guess Cape Town is where they're having it. But that was supposed to be a great accomplishment that he was going to achieve and was going to sort of put Egypt on the map and revive the economy and so forth. Didn't happen, but that's the kind of thing that he's associated with.
Just let me ask you one other question, or give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about the election of 2005. That was the last time Mr. Mubarak stood, mm-hmm. and this was an election that, at a time, I think it was billed as, at least the ruling party billed it as, the first opportunity that there really was an open possibility for somebody else in another party to run. I don't think it turned out that way because the ruling party stacked the deck so that mm-hmm. that was really mm-hmm. impossible. Muslim Brotherhoods, they couldn't run. It was very difficult for independent candidates to run. So in a sense, the only party that had the infrastructure to really be able to mount a campaign was the ruling party. Mm-hmm. But having said that, was that just an empty gesture saying, well, this is really the first time that there's going to be an open contest for president? Or is there any way in which that does represent a kind of an opening, even though it might be very small?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I think that one of the question really is, what was Mubarak responding to, sort of grassroots pressure from below? Probably not that much. Or was it from, the Americans and the Europeans sort of leaning on him to democratize, and probably a bit more in that direction? Nevertheless, it has had some effect. And, of course, the American pressure and I was off. Back then, we were sort of on a rampage. It looked like Bush was riding high and democratization in the Middle East would be the thing. And so there was a need to placate, the Americans with this. And, of course, as you said very accurately, the fine print was maintained so that the result was in 2005, we had the first ever contested political election, a presidential election in Egypt, but it was rigged so that the NDP literally was the only party that could field a serious candidate, and that was Mubarak. But the interesting thing is that in all of these moves the regime has made recently, including the most recent 34 amendments to the Constitution put through in March, which are really aimed at ensuring the continuity of National Democratic Party rule and probably Gamal's succession, they're still working within a legal frame, which is interesting. It's not like Zimbabwe where the guys are going out and they are arresting people, but they're not arresting everybody and simply breaking all the rules. They're playing with the Constitution. They're passing new laws, and the reason they have to do this is because the judiciary, which is semi-independent at least from the executive in Egypt, have invalidated every election law since the early 1980s, which is why every round the parliament controlled by the regime has to come up with a new way of stacking the deck. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that they operate within a legal framework. There is this sort of notion that, well, we have to do this according to the rules somehow.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Ken Cuno. He is Associate Professor of History at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. We're talking about current developments in Egypt. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit more about this referendum this past spring on the amendments to the Constitution. But before that, let's take a step back, because I want to have you talk a little bit about the emergency. When Sadat was assassinated, this state of emergency was declared, mm-hmm. and the emergency kept going.
Mm-hmm.
And it's my understanding, I think, that these changes to the Constitution are supposed to, in a sense, take the place of the provisions of the emergency. Just let me have you talk a little bit about the emergency and what exactly were the terms of the emergency and what sort of emergency powers did the government have there for 26 Yeah. Something like 26 yeah. years. It was the continuing emergency.
Yeah. They still have them, in fact, in place. Yeah. Well, every constitutional state has a has something in the Constitution that says, look, if we have an emergency and things are really dire, like, you know, the Japanese attacking Pearl Harbor, then we can suspend the normal constitutional guarantees against preserving privacy, against detention without charges and so forth because of the emergency. And that's what emergency laws are. So Egypt, in fact, has been under a version of emergency laws since the military revolution of 1952. And prior to Mubarak's presidency, it was only for a period of 3 or 4 years that they didn't have them. And I think that may have been just before Sadat's assassination. And yes, when after Sadat's assassination, a new emergency law was issued, and they pretty much have been in place straight through Mubarak's presidency. They have to be renewed every 2 years. And again, this suspends the normal habeas corpus and fair rules. And also under the emergency laws, beginning in the early 1990s, when Egypt had a spate of domestic terrorism aimed at the Gamaa Islamiyah, aimed at tourists, among other things. But there were also bombs being set off in Cairo in the early 90s. It was very worrisome for a time. And thousands and tens of thousands of suspected Islamists were detained. And the first batches of them were sent to trial, and they didn't get convictions, or they didn't get as many convictions as they wanted. Also, the assassins of Sadat were tried in a regular civilian court, so the record is open on that. And it was at that point in the early 90s then that Mubarak said, okay, right, we're going to try these guys in military courts. And so the emergency laws basically gave him the power to say, if you are a suspected terrorist, we're going to try you in a military court and not in a civilian court so we can get the results we want. Now, these laws have to be renewed every 2 years. Human rights campaigners have been putting pressure on the government. It makes them look bad. As American allies. One of the amendments passed in March by the parliament, and then the way it works constitutionally is for a constitutional amendment, the parliament has to approve it by a two-thirds margin. And the NDP controls about four-fifths of the seats, by the way. And then after that, it's approved in a general plebiscite, a yes or no vote. And this was, I'm trying to remember, I've got it here someplace. This was Article 179, amended to in the Constitution to enable the president to refer any terrorist charge to any court he likes. And in cases related to terrorism, the normal protections against arbitrary arrest, search without warrant, and violation of privacy can be set aside. Now, this is essentially the powers he's had under the emergency laws. And so Mubarak watchers in Egypt are basically saying, okay, what this is setting up now a situation where they can let the current emergency laws, which again have to be renewed after 2 years, expire without renewing them, and then they can say, you see, now we don't have emergency laws anymore. We're going in the right direction because the Constitution now takes care of this.
Well, does this changes to the Constitution, which did pass the referendum?
Oh, yes.
Was, and of course, that's what everybody expected, that it would pass. Yeah. Nobody had any doubt that it would pass, although the turnout was pretty low, in the high 20s, something like that.
The government, or rather the NDP, claims it was 27%, but independent observers say it was more like 5% turnout, which is consistent with presidential elections and parliamentary elections in the past.
So does this now, in addition to taking these powers that the government had before under the emergency, would had to continually be renewed, other than the fact that it takes those powers and in a sense makes them permanent so that they don't have to go through that business every 2 years, does this give power, any power to the government that the government did not have before? Is there anything about this that is actually new?
With regard to Article 179, no. It is basically enshrines, I guess you could say, the terms of the emergency laws in the Constitution. With regard to alleged cases of involvement in terrorism, not everything else necessarily. So when I was there back in the old days under President Sadat, everybody in academia knows somebody who was a leftist or a communist at one point or another, and they were routinely, picked up and detained, especially before elections. Now, supposedly, you would have to, the president would have to say, well, this guy is a terrorist or he's involved in a terrorist organization, even if he is a communist or something like that. Mm-hmm. So that narrows it perhaps a bit, but you can accuse anyone of terrorism, I would think.
It also, and there are some other amendments that do things like it bans religious parties. It gives now the president fairly broad powers to actually dissolve the parliament. I'm not sure what sort of justification has to be given, but it seems that essentially what it does, that it preserves the power of the ruling party, perhaps even gives the ruling party more power than it had mm-hmm. before, and if anything, would cement its control over politics.
Aside from that, well, actually, that Article 179 that I mentioned about replacing the emergency laws is, of course, aimed at the Muslim Brotherhood. It's aimed at real terrorists, but also at the Muslim Brotherhood. Virtually everything else of substance in the amendments is also aimed at making it much, much more difficult for the Muslim Brotherhood to participate in the political process in a legal and peaceful way, but essentially blocking their avenue to success. You mentioned, I think it was amended Article 5, which not only bans religious-based political parties. I mean, that ban was in place in electoral laws prior to that, which is one of the reasons that the Brotherhood could not and has not organized itself as a political party. In fact, they are technically an illegal organization. So the deputies they have in Parliament, the 88 deputies, ran as independents, which they could do under the electoral law going back to 1990, which created single-member winner-take-all districts, like our congressional districts. So basically, politics becomes very local, and that gives independents who have the respect of the community a good shot. But so all the Brotherhood deputies in Parliament are actually technically independents and not members of a party. So the amendment to the article not only bans religious-based parties, but what it does is it forbids, quote-unquote, any political activity within a religious frame of reference or any religious basis or on the basis of gender or origin. So religious, this key phrase, religious frame of reference, is a phrase that moderate Islamist parties, for example, in Morocco as well as in Algeria and Egypt, have been using recently to sort of signal that, okay, we aren't a religious party. We are a party, let's say, analogous to the Christian Coalition, that merely wants to bring religious values into politics, but we're not going to be dictatorial or authoritarian or anything like that. So it's basically trying to present themselves as more democratic. Now, of course, there is the question of sincerity. That's another question. But basically trying – this is a strategy to enable them to participate in politics on a legal and you know, ballots and not bullets. But here, then, this is even banning that. And you notice that there's also a little roadside bomb put in that amendment for gender-based activities of any sort. So
women's somebody comes along and says we're the party that represent the women of Egypt.
You can't organize a political party based upon gender. So there can be no women's party, nor one based on origin. I presume means ethnicity. So there can be no Berber or Bedouin political party or something like that. Mm-hmm. But the ban on political activity in general means that they could target women's groups if they wish to. They've done it in the past when they felt like it on other bases. But it's interesting that was tossed in there.
We are at our midpoint here in this part of Focus 580, talking about Egypt and Egyptian politics today. Ken Cuno is our guest. He is Associate Professor of History here at University of Illinois. We have somebody who would like to join in the conversation. Others are certainly welcome if you'd like to ask questions. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone in Charleston. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello. Hello, Professor Cuno.
Good morning.
I was just wondering if, since you just brought up the subject of gender, you might be able to talk about Nawal al-Sa'adawi a little bit, because people in town might want to know about the fact that she's being accused again of apostasy. I don't know if you're aware.
Again?
You're not aware of that then?
Well, not the most recent round, but this is a regular thing.
Right, right. Okay. So I guess you won't need, I mean, maybe you could talk about being accused of apostasy in general.
Who's accusing her?
Apparently she wrote a...
And it's not the government, is what you're saying.
No, it's not the government, so maybe you don't want to deal with the issue, but she wrote something called God Dies by the Summit.
Sure.
God Resigns at the Summit, sorry. So I would imagine that actually the God figure is a patriarchal ruler like Mubarak, but I haven't read the piece. It was a play. But I don't know whether she's in more trouble than she was before, because she ran for president for a while. So I'm not sure. I guess maybe you're not able to address the issue, but at least people will be aware that they could probably find a petition online,
mm-hmm.
which I don't know
mm-hmm.
how useful that would be.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering now, with what you're saying, whether she'll have more trouble getting support from the government, given that she ran for president before, in terms of getting out of these charges.
Well, I don't know if she can possibly have more trouble
mm-hmm.
than she's had over the years. But this is and I have to apologize. I wasn't aware that there had been new accusations against her, but these are rather typical things. It's called in Arabic takfir, the accusation of unbelief or the denunciation of unbelief, which is essentially declaring a fellow Muslim to be an apostate. And for the radicals, of course, that means that one should be put to death for apostasy, although
right.
in actual Islamic jurisprudence, that's all hedged around with all kinds of rules of evidence and due process and so forth. Such that it was almost never enforced. The thing about Noelle is, and she's author of multiple books and has done films and so forth and so on. So anybody listening interested in reading up on about her or hearing about her can do so easily by going to the net. She's been a very strong feminist for many years. Her background is in medicine, and she's been a leading voice and a well-known voice also in the West for women's rights. She also has and she's a very stalwart person, she also has a very sort of in-your-face kind of approach. She's very confrontational, running for president, a good example of that, in 2005. And, of course, this is partly what sets people off. And so I'm not surprised. I mean, in the past, she's also had death threats and so forth and so on. And these things have to be taken seriously. But you know, this is her style. I should also mention in this context that there are numerous feminist organizations as well as individuals who are working with much lower profiles than Noelle, who are not publishing books that are instantly translated into English and French. And who are actually accomplishing a lot of things. So I'd also encourage people who are interested in, you know, gender politics in Egypt or in the Middle East generally to go to websites like Women Living Under Muslim Laws, for example, and to see what's being done there and the kind of networking and organizing that is going on. A lot of the Muslim feminists are working to convince governments, such as Egypt's, that the gender discriminatory laws that they have in place are actually not Islamic, but reflecting customs, and that a better understanding of Islam would result in a greater degree of liberalization. And they've had a fair amount of success in various countries like Egypt and Morocco and in Jordan in revising the public personal status laws in a more woman-friendly direction.
Okay, well, thanks a lot. And let me just spell Noelle Asadawi's names in case anyone's interested. The first name is Noelle, N-A-W-A-L. Then she spells the L-E-L. And then it's a new word, Saadawi, S-A-A-D-A-W-I. So thanks a lot.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go to another caller. This is Normal, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just have a number of claims. I'd like to see what your comments on them are.
Sure.
The first would be states create terrorist, and that countries like Turkey should learn from the experience of countries like Egypt and Algeria and others about accommodating Islamist parties. Second, that 9/11, the roots can really be traced to the first World Trade Center bombing and to Egypt and to the combination of the Egyptian jihadist with Al-Qaeda. And third, that Syed Qutb has been unfairly demonized without people fully understanding his life and his life works. So I just wonder if your comment on any or some of those. Thank you.
I'm not quite sure where to start. States create terrorists. Well, a state to be a state has to have a monopoly of violence. Otherwise, it's not an effective state. In our conversation earlier on this question of should the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt specifically be accommodated or not, as the caller was saying, the AKP, the Justice and Welfare Party in Turkey, has been running the government since 2003. That question really is hard one to resolve. Because the situation in Egypt, unlike in Turkey, the political situation has not allowed for, say, incremental electoral gains and experience with, say, Muslim brethren winning municipal elections and running local units of government or something like that and showing whether they are more honest or less honest than the other guys or more hardline or more moderate than the other guys. So it's very hard for the Brotherhood doesn't really have that opportunity. They're doing their best to present a democratic, legal, and nonviolent face. But even if I think the approach of the government were more accommodating, which I think would be a good idea, nevertheless, these questions about is the Brotherhood really a bunch of good guys or not would still persist, and there's really no way of testing it unless you go all the way. I'm not sure what the point of...
Can I just make a comment on that? Because these are connected. It seems to me that your comment really doesn't appreciate the history of the Brotherhood. It was at one time in 1949 led by a pacifist, for example. It was radicalized primarily by Nasser imprisoning Qutb on two occasions, one in 56 and one in 66. And part of what happened in the first World Trade Center bombing was due to the radical effect of the Brotherhood breaking off and being shunted out of Egypt, and it went to two places. It went to Germany, and it went to Newark, New Jersey. So, those are just indications of how the Brotherhood, first of all, changes given the circumstances.
But this is not the Brotherhood, as you said. This is a group of, there's a tendency that separated from and broke off from the Muslim Brotherhood and haven't been a part of it since the late 60s or early 70s. Which is the distinction I was making.
But
you're quite correct that Ayman al-Zawahiri and his group, the Egyptian jihad organization, do have roots that go back to that period in the early 70s and late 60s. And whether or not there was a direct connection, there certainly was, as far as I understand, an inspiration from Syed Qutb. And the current Brotherhood, which is still the Brotherhood with the name and not the people, not the dissenters who are now in the probably a northwest frontier province in Pakistan, they take a very ambiguous position vis-a-vis Syed Qutb's writings, but basically they distance themselves from the call to revolutionary violence.
Yes, but those who adopt could, for example, Al-Qaeda, I think it's what's overlooked is the fact that Qutb wrote Milestones, which had been banned in Egypt, in response to further oppression, because he watched Nasser let loose his guard and watched many of his Muslim brethren die before him during a hunger strike for better conditions in the prison. So I'm just saying each time the state takes very repressive measures, it radicalizes these groups, and the less it accommodates them, the more radical and more violent they get.
Well, I think the reason that states adopt repression is because repression sometimes works as well. Sometimes it can be quite effective. And not that I want to contest your rather theoretical argument, but let me point out that in Turkey, for example, the moderation of the AKP after the experience of the soft coup of 1991, which got rid of the first Islamist-led government in Turkey, led by Erbakan, the moderation of the AKP in Turkey is explained in large extent. This is the government of Erdogan. In terms of them having learned a lesson from the repression and also having looked across the sea to see what was going on in Algeria. And with the strategy of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt in recent years also has been explained by some of their own people in terms of, yes, we've saw what happened in Algeria. We don't want to have that happen to us or to our country. So I well, I'm quite aware of this theory that, you know, repression radicalizes, and I'm concerned. And in fact, we're hearing comments about this now with this the amendments to the Constitution passed in March in Egypt, which, you know, one possible outcome of this is that if they are effective in blocking the Brotherhood's strategy of peaceful political engagement in the process in Egypt, it might empower the hardliners within the Brotherhood, and as the caller indicated, it certainly might lead to a turn to revolutionary violence. But one of the key things I think that needs to be appreciated here is that the guys who do this are not simply puppets. I mean, they have decisions to make. They have their own ideology. They have their own strategies, and they also make choices when faced with repression. Repression isn't nice. One shouldn't do it. But nevertheless, these guys make choices, too, as to what to do once they're faced with these setbacks or with this repression.
I want to appreciate the comments of the caller. I need to jump in here. We have just about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Ken Cuno. He is Associate Professor of History here at University of Illinois. He teaches on the history of the Middle East and is specifically interested in Egypt. And we're talking here about contemporary Egyptian politics. Questions, are welcome. We certainly have time for some others. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The United States, in its policy in the Middle East, has talked a lot about the promotion of democracy and their interest in seeing greater democracy. Egypt is an important ally of the United States. Has the United States said anything about, particularly about this, generally about the Egyptian government's tendency to discourage and hold back any and all political opponents, and then particularly now these amendments to the Constitution, that if anything, solidify the government's power to do that? Does the United States say anything about this?
Well, we've been very inconsistent. And I think this has to do, I would say, it has in part to do with the fact that I think really that democratization, although our government has talked a lot about it, it's really a secondary goal, or perhaps even window dressing to strategic goals in the region. Yes, going back a couple of years, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and others in Washington, but Secretary Rice, even in a trip to Egypt in, I think it was in 2005, had some pretty strong words for the Mubarak government and spoke in terms of, in a speech she gave at the American University in Cairo, in terms of supporting democracy and criticized previous American administrations for putting up with or tolerating autocracy for many, many years and kind of signaled, now we're going to go in another direction. And she seemed to be encouraging a kind of one of these color revolution, you know, orange revolution or green or whatever revolution in Egypt. And then all sorts of things happened. I mean, 2006 was not a good year for the Bush administration. It was supposed to be the year in which we turned the corner in Iraq with all the political stuff set up, and that didn't happen. Things went downhill. They lost Congress in November. And then democratization in the Middle East hit a road bump in January of 2006. I guess I got my dates mixed up. Anyway, 2006, January, with the Palestinian elections in which Hamas surprised everyone, including themselves, by winning a majority of seats in the parliament. And at that point, I have no doubt that President Mubarak's people were on the phone to the White House saying, "I told you so," because this has been the Egyptian line all along, going way back to Sadat's time. Don't push us. You know, we got to do this our own way, not only with politics, but also with economic reform. Don't push us too far because you don't want another Iran, do you? And who's the only viable opposition? Well, never mind the fact that we've created this situation for ourselves. It suits our purposes. So I think the turning point was in February of 2006 when Secretary Rice went back to Egypt on part of a tour, and the government had rearrested and at this point convicted Ayman Nour, who was the runner-up in the presidential election of 2005. He had been initially to discourage him from running with his new party, the Tomorrow Party, against Mubarak. He had been arrested in early 2005 on what seemed to be fabricated charges of voter registration fraud. And with heavy American and very public American pressure, he was released from prison and allowed to contest the election, and he got 7%. Against Mubarak, which was better than anybody else did against Mubarak. Then in December of last year, he was rearrested and tried and convicted, and he's serving a six-year prison sentence, even though he's a diabetic and his health is bad and that sort of thing. When Secretary Rice was in Cairo last February, she didn't say anything. She didn't raise the issue. Mubarak was asked by journalists, "Did she ask you about Ayman Nour?" And he said no. And so more recently, expressions of disappointment or concern coming out of low-level officials in the State Department, that's how it's downplayed. So, no.
We have another caller here in Belgium nearby, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Just a moment ago, you alluded to the question I was going to ask, or aspect of the question I was going to ask. Mr. Mubarak does suppress all of the people who seem to be running against him, but at the same time, isn't he drastically afraid of some religious groups coming in and making it a much worse place than what it could be? And maybe very much like Turkey, where they try to keep religion and politics as separate as they possibly can.
Well, this is you must have tuned in partway through, because this is what we've been talking about with the equivalent to the Islamist AKP party in Turkey is potentially the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, who, although are currently not a political party and they're not even a legal organization. And the big question is, and this is referenced to an earlier caller's point as well, that if President Mubarak was a Democrat with a small d, which he is not, and if he wanted to encourage democratization, then perhaps facilitating and encouraging the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a religious-based organization, to participate more in politics might be a way to encourage moderation on their part and so forth. I mean, that's one scenario. But there are these lingering questions about the Muslim Brotherhood that have not been addressed effectively by them to allay the fears of their opponents and critics. One case in point is that internally the Muslim Brotherhood does not have a democratic structure. It has a supreme guide, and everyone is supposed to follow what the supreme guide and there's a council he runs sets the policy. Even though there are different factions within the Brotherhood, different tendencies, it is not internally organized, democratically speaking. That's one thing. Another thing is its position on women and women's rights. They've been rather ambiguous, but in general, when they come out with something publicly, it's about greater degrees of controls on women's public behavior than exist now. What about Christians? Again, the country is maybe 10% Christian. They are legally now they are full and equal citizens, although a lot of cops will complain privately about discrimination. It's not de jure discrimination. There are elements within the Muslim Brotherhood in the past who have said things like, well, maybe we should bring back some of these, you know, disabilities on Christians. So there's this whole range of questions that the Brotherhood itself hasn't really addressed yet to allay these fears, while at the same time, of course, it's dealing with a constant repression, disruptive activities by the government. I mean, there's been a campaign against them, including a series of arrests of their leaders over the past several months.
If I might direct your attention also in another slightly different direction, the situation that's now developing in the Palestinian area between Hamas and Fatah, mm-hmm. What do you think that's going to happen in Egypt? There seems to always be a relationship there.
I don't think it's going to have a really direct impact on Egypt or Egyptian politics per se. Egypt, the Egyptians would like to play a positive role in helping settle down things in Gaza, but there's really not much they can do.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One thing I'd like to have you maybe talk a little bit about, and we're down to the point where we have just a couple of minutes left, mm-hmm. is apparently within the past year or so, particularly since the beginning of the year, there has been a lot of labor unrest mm-hmm. in Egypt. A lot of strikes and demonstrations and work stoppages, all of which I think, as I understand, technically are all illegal. Is there some particular reason why that has happened, and is there some potential for organized labor being a kind of a political power base for somebody?
Well, the main reason these things are happening seems to be the pattern seems to be a series of broken promises of pay raises or benefits which have not been delivered on and have really angered the workers. And take-backs, what's known as take-backs in the American labor movement, meaning where there's an effort to cut back on benefits or reduce pay or lay workers off. And the aside from the continuing, you know, dire economic situation and where workers' families are just scraping by, they don't have much margin which lose things. The structural thing behind this is, of course, the continuing liberalization of the economy under pressure from the U.S., the World Bank, the IMF, structural readjustments, it's called, and the selling off of private sector industries. These strikes are happening mainly in the public sector, and they started in factories that were about to be privatized or in the process of being privatized, and then the workers, of course, are losing benefits and pay. Now, so it starts off with bread and butter issues, I think you could say. And there has been some talk amongst Egyptian liberals and leftists who are not in the labor movement or are not themselves workers about how this might lead to something. And there has been a certain amount of networking between the political parties and the workers, but not much has come of that. This is the sort of thing, I think, where it's certainly not something threatening the regime, mm-hmm. but it's the sort of thing where the Americans could perhaps make a little bit of difference with just a few words here and there saying, well, by the way, we think workers' rights are a good thing, or of course, this administration, you can't expect too much. But nevertheless, whether it comes to workers' rights or women's rights or the rights of minorities or whatnot, we don't need to do a high profile, denounce them every once in a while when somebody is arrested, but rather just sort of be consistent and stand by principles and just sort of let people know that our consistent policy is to be in favor of these things that are rights-based and maybe stop well short of having free and fair elections, but at least help to build a platform. Another thing we could do is to take seriously the various international agreements sponsored by the UN over the past 25 to 30 years in favor of the rights of women, the rights of children, the rights of workers, the rights of minorities, religious freedom against torture and mistreatment of non-military prisoners and so forth. If we got off our nationalism and actually supported these agreements, which are taken very, very seriously around the world, that also would be a way of applying soft pressure on Egypt and other countries to conform more to those standards, and in a way that would not get their nationalism up and make them resist.
Yeah. So, we're pretty much at the point where we have to finish. I guess the long and the short of it is that I would not expect anything in the way of radical change anytime soon in Egyptian politics, given that the ruling party will continue to be the ruling party, and chances are probably quite good that the son of Hosni Mubarak is going to be the next president, and then that things probably won't change very much anytime soon.
Yeah, well, we can hope for gradual change, though.
All right. Well, at that, we will have to finish for this time around. Our guest is Ken Cuno. He is Associate Professor of History here at the University of Illinois. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.